Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Again, it's great to have you here this morning. As probably most of you know, this is the first in a series of 4 weeks of introductory talks. So what I'm going to be talking about are some basic Buddhist teachings and the Zen practices that grow out of them. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about dimensions of practice, aspects of practice, and a little bit about a history of Zen. And then we're going to dive into the teachings of emptiness and no self. Later on in the next weeks, we're going to talk about Buddha nature and the Bodhisattva vow and the role of faith and all kinds of important dimensions of our practice. And then finally, in the last week, we'll swing back through the dimensions of practice and see what we've learned. The main thing to remember, I'm going to say this over and over again, the main thing to remember, but I really do believe this, that these teachings are not meant to be abstract. They're not meant to float out someplace that over here, or like a cartoon bubble over your head. They're meant to support and deepen your practice. They're meant to guide your daily life. Okay? Okay. What this means is that you don't need to be anyone else other than you are right now. Okay? You don't need to be a perfect version of yourself. You don't need to be able to get yourself into a full lotus posture. You don't need to be able to sit still for hours on end. You don't need to be endlessly kind, supportive, and serene. This practice is made for human beings. Grumpy, impatient, loving, thoughtful, careless, all the things that you are meant to be touched by the teachings. The other thing is, don't feel that you need to understand these things perfectly. You won't. None of us do. If we wait until we understand the teachings perfectly, we'll be dead before we practice. So what I want you to do is take these teachings in, consider them, reflect on them, allow them to touch your ordinary life. The study of Zen Buddhism should never be tense or grim. Okay? No. Like that. So that's a waste of time. If we lose our sense of humor, if we lose our joyful heart, if we lose our humility, we're sunk, basically. So this is, I want you to keep it soft and keep it vigorous. Okay, keep it soft and keep it vigorous. The teachings can stand up to any questions. In fact, if there's one hallmark of Zen practice, I would say it's fearless questioning. There's a kind of ferocity to our questioning, a kind of depth and seriousness to our questioning. So don't hold back. Don't swallow your questions. Likely, if you have a question, so do others. So my request to you is to practice fearlessness and speak up. Okay, there'll be time for questions. Just some other housekeeping kind of things. There's study books available. You can borrow one. You can buy one if you want for the cost of printing. And Sue, will you handle that? If anybody is interested in one of these books, please speak to Sue. next Saturday morning, I'm going to be doing Zazen instruction at 8:30. So if you'd like to come and review Zazen instruction with me, I will do that then. And then the last day of this four series, we're going to have two, and then Shinshu and I are going to be gone for a week, and Mr. Hollingshead is going to give a talk, and then I'll be back for 2 weeks. Okay? And that last of the series on June 17th, we're having a half-day sitting. So if you'd like to spend a morning sitting together in community, please carve out some time to do that with us. You don't have to stay the whole morning, but it's a really nice way to end up this little period of study. We also have other study and practice activities over our usual schedule coming up. We're going to have a study group and class on Monday nights starting in September. So if you're if you want to hear about those things, just there's sign-up sheets out there. Okay. So I want to ask you, some of you know this is a kind of trick question, but anyway, what do you think Zen practice is? Yes, Sue?
Everyday living.
Everyday living. Yeah.
Self-fulfillment.
Self-fulfillment. Okay. Anybody else?
Practicing being a human.
Practicing being a human. Uh-huh. Anybody else? Dandy.
Appreciating the moment.
Appreciating the moment. These are great. These are great. These are all really great. And each one we could take and look at each word. You know, what is the... In fact, part of what we're going to be doing here is, what is a moment? What is the self? What is fulfillment? What are these things? What do each of these statements mean? One way that I've described Buddhist practice is all the activities a person takes up that allow them to deepen their understanding and expression of Buddhist teachings in their everyday lives in a way that reduces their own suffering and the suffering of others. Okay? So all of the activities that you do that allow you to deepen your understanding of the teachings and express the teachings in such a way that your suffering and the suffering of others are alleviated. So this is a very positive vision of our lives, and it's a very rich and positive vision of our day-to-day activities. Our day-to-day activities are a transformative field. So in Zen practice, we ground ourselves in the teachings. We take time to sit. We support one another in community. And we do this with the knowledge that our life is the practice. Another thing is that in Soto Zen practice, the first movement of practice, the very first moment that it occurred to you, it's time to sit down, or it's time to go to the Zendo, or it's time to listen to the Dharma, is the very same, is as full and complete as 30, 40, 50 years down the road. It's that spark of not knowing. It's that desire to live. It's called bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, the mind that wants to fulfill our full humanness. This mind is the same mind 10 years later, 20 years later, 30 years later, 40 years, 50, 60, all those years later. It's totally trustworthy. So the millionth time we come back to remembering who we are, it's that same freshness. So the first thing we do when we approach Zen practice is we dislodge the idea that practice is limited to sitting on a cushion. We take refuge, as we say, in the Buddha. We take refuge in the Dharma. And we take refuge in the Sangha. So the Buddha we can think of as our awakened heart, our mind that sees clearly, Dharma is the teachings, the Sangha is the web of relationships. So we discover Buddha, Dharma, Sangha at work, at home, at in line at the grocery store, with an aging parent or a rambunctious toddler, when we're ill, when we're lonely, when we're at ease, when we're joyful, all of these times. Zazen does hold a central place in the teachings. Katagiri Rishi used to say, you know, when you actually look at human life, it's a natural response to want to sit down for a little while. Right? So to sit still for a period of time, to take the time to sit still, is to honor the depth and beauty of all that we are. All that we are given in this moment. In Zazen, sitting on a chair, sitting on the ground, sitting on a bench, we cultivate a dignified posture and we attend to this moment in its fullness. We pay attention. We do this not in order to become something else. Our lives are usually filled with acquisition, aren't they? We use this to get to that. We learn this to get to that. We want to be able to, I don't know, cook a perfect loaf of bread. But Zazen has a different spirit to it. Zazen means we sit in the faith that we are already Buddha. What do you think of that? We sit in the faith that already this fully awakened mind is present. We drop this habitual acquisitive mind that we're going to go from one thing to the next. We're going to get someplace perfect. And then, when we get everything lined up and all our ducks in a row, then maybe we'll wake up. So this isn't to disparage our human capacity to move from one thing to the next, to plan, to get some place and all that. We've got that covered, most of us. This is a different kind of sitting. So we're not in acquisition mode. We pay attention in our work lives, in our relational lives. If we practice formal zazen, we take care with our bowing, with the offerings. We come together as a community to recognize our struggles, our joys, our difficulties, our mutuality. This is Sangha. Buddha is present always. Dharma we study in everything. Dogen Zenji says, your bones are the bones of the sutra. When you study your bones, you study the sutra, the sacred teachings. We study our lives. We study our bodies, our minds, our hearts. We study the scripture. So we take refuge in the Dharma, and we take refuge in community, whatever that is for us. So there's a kind of clear-eyed effectiveness that we want to cultivate. This is not mush brain, right? We study what brings wholesomeness to our lives. So, all of these things we do, but right now, we're going to talk about the specific teachings of emptiness. I want to say that patience is required in studying these teachings. It's not about getting it straight, it's about allowing it to enter your life. There are no tests. Only the experience. Ambiguity, paradox, what Dogen said you called fu'e, not knowing, always returning to not knowing, to risk having yourself changed by the teachings. In Buddhism, there is no pope. There's no committee of elders to tell you this is true, this is not true. It's an offering. The Dharma is an offering. You see for yourself what works and what doesn't work. Does a study of the teaching create more compassion, more aliveness, more joy, more sensitivity, more strength in your life, or not? We make it real. So, the Buddha, as you all know, was born about 2,500 years ago, and he lived and taught and died, and his teaching came from his living, his awakening, his experience in community. So these are not tablets that came down from on high. The teachings grew out of human life. So try them on. There are many, many systems of Buddhism, many ways that the Dharma has taken shape. You can travel around Santa Cruz and find whole bunches of different teachings, right? We're very lucky. Very lucky. And it can also be very confusing. So if what you hear from me sounds different than what you might have heard from another Dharma teacher, it probably is. But don't worry about it. Just, again, allow the different streams of the Dharma to touch you, follow what makes sense for you, and make it real. When the Dharma traveled to China, it encountered Chinese culture. And one of the things that arose from that was called Chan Buddhism. So the word jhana in Sanskrit means meditation. The Chinese heard that as Chan. And then when it went to Japan, to Korea, first it went to Korea, that's Son, and then it went to Japan, and that's Zen. So all of those words are meditation, which means that central to our practice is the practice of meditation. The legend has it that the great teacher Bodhidharma brought Chan to China. And you'll see pictures of him. He has these big eyes, right? Fierce face. It's interesting to note that the first ordained monastic in Japan was a woman. Her name was Zenchin Ni, and she traveled to Korea in 587 to take ordination with two buddies, and then they came back to Japan. The founder of our school, Ehei Dogen, went to China. Is a very perilous journey across the sea, but it's this longing to go to the mother country. You know, it's like we're pioneers and we want to go back. We want to hear the teachings that in a country where it's been present for hundreds of years. So he had this fundamental question, this fundamental quest. If we're already enlightened, why do we bother to practice? Isn't that a great question? Why bother? You could ask yourself the same question. Why did I get up here? Why did I get up and come here? It's a beautiful day outside. Why am I interested in Buddhism? Why bother to practice? It's a very good question. It took him across a perilous journey to China to answer that question. And the way he answered it is that it is in the practice that we find out why we practice, because it transforms our lives. It's in the practice that we wake up, not some time later on. Does this make sense? No. Great. I love it. Thank you. No, it doesn't make sense. Good. If it doesn't make sense, then we chew on it for a while. These questions, in a way, don't make sense. How can I already be awakened? Me? Me who was grumpy at work yesterday? Me who snapped at my grandchild or I don't have a grandchild, so that would be hard. But me, this one, how is that true? How could that be? So good for you for shaking your head no. Because that's the mind of, that's what Suzuki Roshi called beginner's mind. That's the mind of, really? Not knowing, fu-e. And sometimes we do know. We get it. And that's great. And then it changes. Okay? Which is what I'm going to talk about now. So the first teaching we're going to talk about today is the teachings of emptiness, sometimes called sunyata. If you're interested, I recently did an interview with a Vipassana, an interview of three of us, a Vipassana teacher, me, and a teacher in the Tibetan tradition, where the three of us talked about emptiness. And it's in Buddha Dharma magazine, but we made some copies. So if you want to pick one up, and you'll be able to hear these different versions of how we approach these teachings. They're out there, I think. So just feel free to pick one up on your way out if you want to read it. This teaching is often misunderstood. And I actually think that the word emptiness is a pretty poor translation. It has very specific meanings. Sunyata has very specific meanings with profound implications about the way we experience and view our lives and the world. So I always encourage people, emptiness is empty of inherent existence, okay? Empty or without a fixed essence. Empty of separateness. Empty of isolation. Empty of permanence. You get the sense? It does not, it's not a negative term. It's not like an empty glass, or much less that emotional feeling of bereftness or emptiness that we feel in despair or bleakness. It's fullness. To say something is empty of inherent existence is to say that it's always and fully connected. It's always alive. Empty points to the same reality as interbeing. This is one of the uses that Thich Nhat Hanh uses. Complete interconnectedness, complete mutuality, intimacy, relationality. Innumerable causes and conditions come together in each moment to create our reality. This is dependent co-arising. Okay? The great teacher Nagarjuna said, when that exists, this comes to be. On the arising of that, this arises. When that does not exist, this does not come to be. On the cessation of that, this ceases. Well, what that means is everything is connected, right? You wouldn't be here if your parents weren't alive, if you didn't have food and water and air to breathe, if you didn't know how to negotiate your way. It's easy to see in this world, I think, isn't it, that things are connected? I mean, it's in our face, seriously in our face now. We can see that we change. We're born, we die, the things and people and animals around us change and pass away. The teachings say that change is the constant. It's not difficult to see that things affect one another, right? All the time we see this. Driving down the road, we see this. If people don't stay on the right, on the correct side of the road, they'll run into each other. So you couldn't even get from one place to the other if there weren't this dance that was going on all the time. We are so deeply connected that it's beyond our imagination how deeply connected we are. So, just think about a lettuce leaf, for example. That lettuce leaf would not exist without the earth, without water, without the air, without the seed, without previous lettuce, without the person that cared for it. If you didn't grow it and you get a lettuce leaf on your plate, it wouldn't exist for you without the person that picked it, the person that transported it, the person that sold it, without the refrigeration that kept it from going limp, but all the people that made that possible, right? It's endless. It's endless. And when you see this simple little leaf of lettuce, you see it all. You can see it in isolation, but if you listen to the teachings of emptiness, you see the earth, you see the air, you see the person that picked it. And what's our response then? Our response is gratitude, right? Thank you very much, everybody, that picked that lettuce. I need to pay attention to you. I need to be grateful to you, right? The same is true for this bell, right? It came from somewhere. Could be a hat, right? Kind of an odd hat. But who's to say it's a bell? Without the striker, what's this? What is this thing without the bell? A stick, right? It's just a stick. It's covered in something. This is a bowl. Could put the lettuce in it, right? Have a nice salad. Could wear it as a hat. Use it as a doorstop. That's what makes it a bell. The coming together of the striker, the person that made this, the person that shipped it from Japan, right? All of that is present in that. But we often don't pay attention. We don't see all of this. How we name things is a part of this too. So, bell, altar, right? This altar here? We say this is an altar. Well, what makes it an altar? Why is it in, if it was in a bar, it would be a bar, right? Or maybe you'd put your cocktail on it. Or if you put stools around it, it could be in a coffee shop. But it's an altar because the Buddha's on it. And when I look at that altar, I think of the man that made it and his care and generosity in making it for us, our long friendship. I see that he found the wood so that no trees were felled for that. These trees were abandoned trees. He went and found the wood and milled the wood. His expertise in making various things. All of that is present in that altar. Right. So each of these things, when you look in your life, look at the things in your home. Where did they come from? What are the stories on them? What do you call them? Because the other part of the teachings of emptiness is yes, all of these things come together in a lettuce leaf, but it's also us that names that thing, right? I say altar. I see altar. That's my interpretation of this, right? If my eyes aren't looking at this, somebody else could come in and say, oh, great. Why is that statue up there? That would make a great cocktail table. So this dynamic interplay between all of the causes and conditions that cause something to occur, the trees, the water, the air, the lumberjack that cut this tree down but it somehow didn't make it down the San Lorenzo River, all of these things are present. When we cultivate this attitude of flexibility, then our lives become richer, and we can turn on a dime. We say, right? We can lighten up a little bit about all of our attitudes and the things we cling to, the things we name, the things we're so sure of. we can be a little more open, a little more kind. We look at the person in front of them, in front of us, someone we might judge, and we think, I have no idea what brought that person here. I have no idea. Why are they on the streets? How did I end up having a comfortable home? Maybe they're cranky today. I don't know what's going on. I have no idea. Or maybe I know them really well, and I think I've known them for years, and I think I know them, and then I go, whoa, really? You see, the teachings of emptiness teach us how to see, teach us how to relate, that we are never apart from the whole web of existence. And how we see things matters. Nothing has a fixed, separate essence. Nothing. You can look and look and look and look and look, and what you will find always is relationality. Relation after relation after relation after relation. All my relations, as they say. So this teachings of emptiness does not mean that things don't exist. They exist. If I tried to walk through that door without opening it, I would pretty soon figure out that that door existed, right? It wouldn't say, oh, the door is empty of inherent existence, I think I'll walk through it. It doesn't work like that, right? If I want to drink water, I could stick my face into the bowl here. That might be a little odd, but it's good to have a cup. It's got shape. It's real, right? So things exist. The teachings of emptiness tell us how things exist. How do they exist? And when we start to investigate how they exist, we relate differently. So it's not just, also it's just not just lettuce leaves, altars, teacups, bells. It's also us that's dependently arisen. And this can be very challenging. You mean I have no inherent, separate existence? That's scary. I'm not a fixed essence? That can be scary. Really? If I look at myself? But think about it the other way. It's also liberating, right? I have no fixed essence. I can change. I will change, whether I like it or not. I mean, just look at ourselves. You know, are you the same as you were when you were an infant? No. This dynamic interplay of self and other is the teachings of emptiness, is the teachings of dependent co-arising, and it liberates us. The point of studying these teachings is that they transform us in positive ways. So it's not just that according to the Buddha Dharma they're true, it's also that they change us, they touch us, they move us. So we're meant to be liberated from suffering by these teachings. And this dynamic, active, creative self is what is liberated. This caring response, this engagement. I was listening to the news the other day, and you know they just pulled down a statue of Robert E. Lee in New Orleans. They've been doing this around the South. And I was listening to these two men talk about this event. One was a white man and one was a black man. And it was so interesting to listen to them and their investigation of what this meant. Because the white man said, I drove around the square. There's a square called Lee Square. And there's a statue that's on this way high pedestal, right? He said, I drove around that square and I never even noticed like Lee Square. Okay, there's a statue of Robert E. Lee there. Like, what? Okay. The African-American man said, I always noticed. It was blaring, the history of oppression, of slavery, of pain, elevated up. It's a hunk of metal, right? We could look at it and say, well, that's an odd-shaped piece of metal. We could look at it and say, oh, that's a statue of a man. We could look at it and say, oh, I don't know. We could look at it and say, that is the suffering of many, many, many generations of people, right? If we use the teachings of emptiness to say, oh, it's all empty, we negate the meaning and reality of each of those perspectives, right? This is something that can be quite prevalent. Oh, it's all empty. Doesn't matter. It does matter. The particularity matters. The suffering matters. The experiences of us as human beings matter. And if we study the teachings of emptiness from the point of view of the respect and dignity for each position, then we have an opportunity to learn from one another. Does this make sense? So the teachings of emptiness are that all of these perspectives of this hunk of metal are all true. They're all dimensions of the reality. They all need to be included, every single one of them, if we have a hope of working together to transform suffering in ourselves and others. So you see this, the teachings of emptiness take shape in everything from a lettuce leaf to the way we relate to one another. They reduce our clinging. They increase our ability to pay attention, to respect one another. The self that realizes itself to be this interrelationship is freed, is not imprisoned in that moment with fixed ideas, can truly listen to another. So the self that we have, that we habitually return to, is not an obstacle to be overcome, right? It's not a problem to be solved, and certainly not an impediment to be obliterated. That attitude only fuels opposition. When we study the self, we see the suffering that comes from our clinging and our ignorance and our non-attending to all the dimensions of our reality. Our life deepens. We have greater humility, compassion, clarity, effectiveness, greater energy. When we're willing to not pull ourselves out of relationship, but see ourselves as a part of relationship, this is liberating. So we know ourselves to be the self of just this. We don't ignore. We're touched. We're changed by something as simple as a lettuce leaf. Dogen Zenji says, what Buddha means by the self is precisely the entire universe. Jindaiji. Thus, whether one is aware of it or not, there is no universe that is not this self. Okay? What Buddha means by the self is precisely the entire universe. Thus, whether one is aware of it or not, there is no universe that is not the self. that's a challenge to us to think about, to remember, and to ask ourselves, to what degree do I actually experience that and embody that in my day-to-day life? How do I actually invite a sense of relationality into my life? How do I challenge myself to wake up gently, persistently? We persist, right? So I'd like to ask you to think of ways this next week to practice this. Make it concrete for yourself. So as you're preparing dinner, pay attention to the food you've got and consider the elements that contributed to whatever that is that you're eating. You know, turn on the stove, fire appears. Shinju and I lived for a number of years with no electricity when we lived at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center. Wow. You know? Then you come back to electricity and you do this thing. There's this thing on the wall and you push this little lever up and the lights go on. Right? And there's this other thing with a needle and you move the needle and it gets warm. Pretty amazing. So we go through our days, you know, flipping switches and turning on gas stoves or electricity, going to the store buying things to eat. And what I'm inviting us all to do is take a little extra time to study these teachings of emptiness, to study these teachings of dependent co-arising, how things are related. Where can you find an end to that relationship? Anywhere? Nowhere. And what happens to you as a person when you actually do this, when you actually pay attention? When you're listening to another person, when you're at work, and you're noticing the dance of work and how people tend not to run into each other, you know? How's that? That's interdependent. When you're listening to someone and perhaps you want to get away, to think about all of the causes and conditions that brought you to that place with that person. And you can make up a story, right? And it's just a story, but it's still to pay attention. When you hear about the news and struggles in the world, to not shut your heart down, but also not to go into overwhelm. To attend, I think when we do this and we attend in each day, we grow in gratitude for all that we're given in each day and in our vital response to what's happening. So I encourage you to sit quietly if you can. Take some time. Pay attention to your mind and heart and body. See that it changes. It doesn't have to be anything fancy. Come here if you want to sit with the community. But sit down for a while, like Katagiri Roshi says. And you'll see how things change. And when you're going about your daily life, please attend to this relationality and see how it manifests in your life, this emptiness, this sunyata. I think that's all I'll say for today. Next week we'll talk about Buddha nature and the Bodhisattva path.